Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's the show. My show, the Scott Horton Show. Here on Liberty Express and on No Agenda and Liberty Movement Radio and Anomaly Radio and whatever other else radio too. ARS Radio, we're on there sometimes. And it's been a little bit of a hiatus due to their most recent fundraising drive, but I'll be back on KPFK this Sunday morning at 8:30 Los Angeles time. I'm hoping to get Nima Shirazi on the show. You can find the piece he wrote at antiwar.com today, destroying the USA Today's attempted warmongering against Iran. They're horrifyingly shoddy war propaganda. And Nima Shirazi, yeah, he's good on that one. There's a certain percentage chance that I don't know that Nima will be the guest on the KPFK show on Sunday. That would be nice, if you ask me. By the way, Doug Bandow will be on this show today. Doug, hey, get this. I emailed Doug, and he said, yeah, I can do the show on the first try. I can't believe it. I'm standing here beside myself. It's a miracle. First try, Doug Bandow's like, oh, yeah, your show? Sure. I mean, he likes doing the show. He's a nice guy, you know. But he's so busy, this guy. But I guess I caught him on a lucky Friday. So, good times, too, because this is one of the best things he's written in a long, long time. Oh, man, you know what? I should make a note. Or something else entirely I want to ask him about. That just came to mind. But, man, he wrote this great piece for Forbes called It's Time for Washington to Tell Saudi Arabia to Pound Sand. And I just like the whole tone of that. Oh, you don't like it? Tough. Anyway, Doug Bandow, you know, he's a very libertarian, non-interventionist guy, but he does a very good job of speaking to a U.S. national interest voice, you know, or with one. And, but he just, you know, makes the case that the rest of them miss. For, you know, conflict of interest reasons and other ones. But anyway, good old Bandow. Screw Saudi Arabia, he says. He'll be on the show here in a while to talk about that. All right, so now to the news. I got plenty of news. Oh, wait, first, Scott Horton Show. Oops. First, scotthorton.org. It used to be scotthortonshow.com. I guess it forwards on, presumably. Scotthorton.org. That's the website. You can listen to the show there. You can join up the chat room there. You can check out the whole show and or the interview archives there. More than 3,000 interviews now going back to 2003. And you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. All right, good times. So, I just thought of something stupid that I did. Sorry. Supposed to get the music set to work right today. I guess we're going to have to play yesterday's music. Thursday's music instead of Friday's today. Sorry. Yeah, it's not too bad. It's just I was supposed to remember and I didn't. That's all. Okay, so that's all the housekeeping stuff I got to talk about. Now to the big news. There was a shooting at LAX. Apparently, according to what the cops say, and I actually did not get to see the press conference that's going on right now. In the last couple of minutes, it only just started right before the show. Anyway, apparently it's a former, they're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, I guess I should join up the chat room so you can correct me if I'm wrong. You can write me on my Facebook page. They're saying it's a former TSA guy. Or, pardon me, an off-duty TSA guy. Perhaps a fired, disgruntled TSA guy. Gone postal. And just went and killed other TSA guys. So, I don't know. I'm assuming that that's true. I guess I have a couple things to say about everything, don't I? So here's what I got to say about that. Cops kill innocent people all the time. Every day, pretty much. If not literally, at least figuratively, every day they kill people. And nobody cares. It's just like in the mythical James Bond movies. Every government employee, down to the meter maids, have a license to kill. And they can kill any of us private citizens that they want whenever they want. The only time that they'll ever get in trouble, very rare exceptions, would be like if the cop kills his girlfriend on a Saturday night in a drunken rage. You might get in, you know, you might face a man 4 charge or something. What's the least charge you can get for a homicide? If it's something completely unrelated and off duty. And there actually have been a couple of indictments lately, a couple of charges against cops, but I have yet to see them really go anywhere. Show me cops really getting sentenced to hard prison time for crimes that they commit against regular citizens. I just don't see that happening. I see the crimes on a daily basis. I don't see the punishments for the crimes ever. So, but then the question is, in this case, he killed other cops. So since the reason that they can kill us is because they're all honorary pharaohs, even down to the lowest level government mutt, like a meter maid or a TSA agent, what happens if they kill another honorary pharaoh? What happens if a cop kills another cop? Oh, especially if he's an off-duty cop today. Friday was his day off. And then he kills cops who are on duty. And I know that TSA aren't really cops, but it counts. Meter maids, same difference. Government parking lot attendants? Or do they contract all that out? Do they have licenses to murder too? Probably. Every last deputy sheriff in America sure as hell does have a license to kill whoever. Whenever. But so in this case, the victims are all other TSA agents. So I guess we can, I don't know. Is it fair to expect that this guy's going to really be in trouble now? They took him alive, they say. Is he going to be able to invoke his sovereign immunity as a government agent? And say, listen, I'm like the rest of you, the judges, the prosecutors, the congressmen, the meter maids, the deputy sheriffs. I have a right to kill whoever I want, and I have sovereign immunity from prosecution for any crime I commit against the people of this country. That's what it means, we the people. It means the government created the people of the country, and government agents can do whatever they want with them. But then you get back to the catch-22 thing there. Cop kills another cop. That's probably the only thing that could jeopardize the immunity of one of these people. Because, you know, a shiny little plastic pretend metal badge is a gigantic metaphysical thing that changes everything. You know, it's funny, too. I actually talked with a TSA guy at LAX one time. I'm not saying anything bad should have happened to this guy. I sure hope it wasn't him that got hurt or anything. He was a nice old guy. And I asked him, what is all this? Ain't no terrorism. What are you doing, man? Frisking old ladies and all this. And the thing is, he really was into it. Well, he was off duty at the time. I could talk to him in a personal kind of way, not a, you know, civilian to master kind of way, but just in a, you know, couple of guys kind of a way, you know, on the tram or whatever. And no, this guy really, he was determined. I'm not saying there was no dissonance there or whatever. He was determined to believe the lie. And of course, you know me with the follow-up questions and everything. Not that I'm always the best at it, but come on. little old ladies, little kids. You know there's no terrorism there. It's just, you're the terrorist. You're the one victimizing people. And you know that that's true. Come on, man. And he says to me, no, yeah, no, that's the thing. Grandmas, too, could be terror. For all you know, right? That's his whole thing. Everybody is guilty until proven innocent. For all you know, that little kid is just a ticking time bomb. That old lady is just a diversion. Whatever. Anyway, and I guess at that point he could have killed me with some piano wire and then said, I have sovereign immunity because I'm a government employee and I can kill whoever I feel like, and then that would have been fine, right? Just as long as I don't also have a little shiny badge. And then here's the other thing. I'm sorry for being so cynical about this. I know some people have gotten killed already, and it's way too soon. At least one person is dead in this thing. Others probably terribly wounded, assuming they got shot, you know? But the theater on the part of the government here. Every cop in L.A. out at LAX now. Well, pardon me, but hasn't it been 2.5 hours since they caught this guy? They pretended like it was still maybe, maybe not an active shooter situation. They refused to say, yeah, it was just the one guy and we got him for like an hour or more. People still panicking. People still writing on Twitter that I'm still under lockdown over in Wing B or Company 4 or whatever, waiting for the all clear. Not allowed to leave. Not allowed to leave the airport. Not allowed to get on a plane. Not allowed to do anything except, cower under the seats in the waiting area. But meanwhile, everyone else in the land knows that the thing's been over for an hour and a half. While people in other parts, completely secure, distant parts of the airport, are under lockdown. And while they're closing off runways, they won't let any planes take off. Right? Like, there still may be some Al-Qaeda guys running around, even though that wasn't this. Don't want to take the risk of launching a bunch of planes into the air when they might have a bunch of terrorists on them, except, no, this thing has been over for 2.5 hours. And if nothing else, you nationalists should be concerned that the cops are making the American nation look like a crying tiny baby. You know what? In other places of the world, in fact, in other places in Los Angeles, people are being shot right now. And nobody's locking down the whole freaking city over it. Nobody's turning it into a mini September 11th attack. One TSA agent killed another TSA agent. It could have happened at the barbecue over the weekend, but it didn't. It happened at work. Okay, big deal. Everybody, you know, take a deep breath. That must have been scary when you heard the gunshots and you had to run. Cool, but now everything's fine. So now everybody line back up and get back on your plane and fly away to where you're going. And you know what? The self-importance of these cops. Like, oh, now's our opportunity to parade around like you really, really need us. Is all that matters. But what about the lives of the people trying to get on those planes? Trying to get off planes at LAX? People who are arriving at the last minute for funerals for their loved ones who now can't go. People who miss extremely important business meetings that could have been make it or break it for their future. Or whatever, use your imagination, it's better than mine. But the cops, they don't care about that. Okay, there was a shooting. It was horrible. Horrible! And it was all confined to this small area of the airport, and we've got it taped off with yellow tape. And if you're Catholic, do the thing where you cross yourself and say Hail Mary. Protestants, pray silently or hold hands if you want. Whatever, Shintoists, do Shinto-y things about the sad thing that happened. And then let's go about our day, guys. How many people are getting killed in L.A. right now? And I don't mean the ones who are being, you know, poisoned to death by their pharmacist accidentally or whatever. I mean, how many people are getting shot in L.A. right now? At least a few. And I can see, obviously, that, hey, shooting at an airport, could this be an international incident? Is this going to be the casus belli for the next gigantic phase of America's terror war? Right? But no, we've known that the answer to that is no for hours now. In fact, I heard a guy on CNN, I think before anyone said the guy in custody is former TSA or off-duty TSA. I believe someone on CNN said that there was a threat. Not only did some guy did the dry ice bomb, whatever that was. I suppose it was just a prank that went a little too far, whatever they're saying. But then there was another TSA agent, he said, who, I don't know if he said had been fired or had been sent home. Well, you know, union rules and everything, can't fire a guy. But that he had threatened something. That was what somebody on CNN said. You know, my DVR doesn't do pause or rewind anymore. I don't know why. I should try to ask someone smart about that. But anyway, so maybe there was even a threat from this guy that he was going to do something. I don't know. But so I can see why this is a bigger deal than a few people being shot elsewhere in LA, because it's at an airport. It's like the time that guy attacked the El Al flight counter or whatever back 10 years ago and this kind of thing. So I can see why it's more exciting initially. But I don't know. That's good ratings, I guess. I'm sitting here talking about it. But I would just like to see TV go, okay, all right, everybody be cool. There is something to see here, but let's not, you know, completely freak out. I saw on, you know, the thing that got me off on this tangent was because I saw it was clear on CNN and elsewhere on Twitter that it's over. Whatever it was is over now. And then I see Jeremy Scahill tweeting that, yeah, I'm being redirected to the Inland Empire now. He's got to go to Ontario Airport. John Wayne Airport, I think. Well, why not the one in North Hollywood? The Bob Barker. Isn't it the Bob Barker? I forget. Here, I'm just picturing Bob Barker, but it's not the Bob Barker Airport, right? It's something else. Is it Bob Barker? What the hell? I'm tripping, man. LA is a strange place. Anyway, so Scahill's flight, which was him and, of course, a couple hundred other people probably, right? Assuming it's a full-size jet coming from somewhere, full of people. They have to land 45 miles away or 50 miles away or whatever out there in Ontario. Why can't they land? Okay, make them wait on the tarmac for an extra 20 minutes. The planes are air-conditioned and everything. And you got to wheel around to the far side now to make sure to let them out on the safe side of the building. But the whole thing, you know, I know actual gay guys who are not fabulous like this. You know what I mean? But the cops, they're like a bunch of actresses. And this is their chance to be on the big stage. Finally, finally, something to do. Point a camera at me, guys. Point a camera at me. They all cry as they stand around doing nothing anyway because there's nothing to do. It's ridiculous. In England, the IRA would blow something up. Everybody would be like, dang. And then go get a beer.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. I'm such an idiot. I know you already knew that. Obviously, it's not the Bob Barker Airport. It's the Bob Hope Airport. I've flown in and out of that thing a couple of times anyway. The Bob Barker Airport. Those guys don't even look alike. Not really. Well, I guess nowadays they probably both do. Anyway. So, welcome back to the show. I'm just complaining about the cops, you know. It's sorry to hear that some TSA agent acted like a government agent and committed an unwarranted act of aggression against innocent others. They are wont to do that. Probably the most dangerous people at LAX, generally speaking. It's lucky how little violence they suffer at that airport, considering how many TSA agents are stalking the grounds at all times, suspecting grandmothers, suspecting everyone of could-be, would-be terrorism. Yeah, that was what he said to me, that TSA agent that I was talking to. He said, "You could be a terrorist." And I said, "No, I couldn't. This is my country, man. I'm from here. You're supposedly part of the giant terror war to protect us from the Saudis and the Egyptians who resent us backing their tyrannies. And the Israelis. So, no. You're supposedly my servant and security agent and protector. I am not your suspect. You're barking up the wrong tree. And you know you are, and then you keep doing it anyway. It's the wrong thing. And you know it, too. That was the funny thing, is because we're on the tram. He's off duty. He's not performing his TSA duties on the tram. He's done for the day or whatever. We're just talking. Old black guy. And come on. He knows. Half his brain knows the other half is completely full of it. Give me a break. This whole thing is a show. I'm glad you're making a good salary, but it's at everybody else's expense, dude. You know, I don't know. Seem like, you know, I'm a humanitarian kind of guy. What can I say? Even a TSA agent. I see them as individuals. I see through the costume jewelry that's so important to them. He's just a guy under there. And I like people. I do. Hey, man, what is it with you and your brain where you convince yourself all these stupid, horrible lies just so that you can keep doing the terrible things that you do? Snap out of it, right? He didn't seem like he was really a criminal sort of a type. He had convinced himself that this is the right thing to do. After all, that is the consensus, right? I understand that. That's the consensus. I'm just pointing out that it's stupid and wrong, you know. Bob Barker Airport. Anyway, I got important stuff to talk about. And also, I got Doug Bando coming up on the show. I really like Doug Bando. He's good on foreign policy. He's the author of Foreign Follies. If you like reading books about foreign follies, it's chock full of them. All right. So let's talk about the NSA for a second here. So Feinstein and the Senate Intelligence Committee have gone ahead and approved the Feinstein version of the reform bill in the Senate. I don't know if they had already voted on the thing yesterday when I talked with Trevor Tim, I guess shortly after that. The thing of it is, it legalizes what they've been doing illegally. Which, of course, the FISA Amendments Act of 2008, that was just the Democrats legalizing everything illegal that George W. Bush had been doing. But that wasn't enough. So they've still been breaking the law, collecting all of our metadata and what have you. Feinstein is actually, in a sense, accusing them of all being felons by now and agreeing with me that they're all a bunch of felons by trying to introduce legislation to legalize what they've been doing. If it's all kosher, then why do you need to legalize it? All right, then, that's what I'm saying. See? Criminals. They're all a bunch of criminals. And then this is the big Reform Act. And here's the other joke. I'm sure I'm probably plagiarizing Marcy Wheeler about this one. And that is, so she's all angry, and she's found out all these new things about how they enforce Executive Order 12,333, and et cetera, like this. And now she wants a review, and she didn't know about this whole Google, Yahoo, cloud thieving issue, et cetera. And then, well, so wait a minute. So you're going to introduce reform legislation, and then you're going to have a review? Wouldn't you want to have your review? Which, by the way, you know, this is the lady who, she has been good on torture and did a 6,000-page, her staff put together a 6,000-page torture report, which is, of course, still secret. But, you know, is the deluxe Pentagon Papers, the huge secret history of the Bush torture program. So she is capable, that's the only point I'm making, she is capable, if she chooses, of being thorough, capable of being thorough. But she's going to go ahead and introduce this phony reform legislation that's going to rubber stamp all of the metadata that they've been collecting on everyone. And that's everyone. And that's a map forward and backward in time of your every relationship. I mean, come on. Even if you're taking precautions and you're a personally and professionally paranoid person, still, your cell phone tells the story of your life. That's it. All your contacts, all the people you call when you quit calling them, all of that tells a story about you. Where you are, all that metadata, all your all the metadata in your photographs that you send back and forth has GPS location in it all. And plus the triangulation stuff. I guess if they want to go back, they can look at all that, all the metadata for your location, whatever. I guess they deny that they've been collecting all the location data all along. They say only for a while they did and then they stopped, but I don't know about that. But anyway, that's the Democrats' idea of reform for you. And did you notice the entire attitude of the political class in America is, yeah, well, the American people, screw them. If we got to collect data on you so we can build a haystack big enough to sift through or whatever ridiculous metaphor that they come up with, then that's just tough and you're just going to have to take it. And who really cares about that? But oh boy, Angela Merkel, huh? Yeah, the president, the prime minister, whatever, a foreign country chancellor of Germany. Oh goodness, her poor feelings and privacy and trust has been breached. Please continue to screw yourself, regular people. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. I'm your host, Scott Horton. It's my show. All right, so I swear I'm going to try my hardest to really get some work done on this book, Goliath, by Max Blumenthal. I can't interview him again until I read it, so I got to hurry up and read it. I need to just lock myself away in some stranger's basement somewhere where no one can find me for about a month and catch up on my books. I'm so far behind on reading books. I can't stand it. It's driving me crazy. And there's a lot of great interviews in those books. You know, that's the thing. I want to read them so I can understand them so I can better recommend them to you. It's the Facebook. It's like a malware in my brain. Controls my brain. And the Twitter. It's stupid. It's horrifying. And I hate it. And it's so useful. And the gratification is instantaneous. And I'm trying to stop. I'm trying to get back to the books. All right. Like I promised, Doug Bandow is coming up on the show here in a little while. So yeah, hang around. That's going to happen. Now, Israel's been bombing Syria. So, in other words, Benjamin Netanyahu and the Likud party and all the neocons and Israel firsters in America are all treasonous traitors on the side of Ayman al-Zawahiri and the al-Qaeda movement. And that goes for the president, too. And yeah, it's true that Obama did not go ahead and bomb Syria. He didn't really want to, you could tell. And thank goodness, and the American people insisted that he not, which was very helpful for his decision. The Israel lobby, of course, was pushing hard. But he's still been backing the Mujahideen there all along. And having the Saudis do it for you isn't plausible deniability to me. What's plausible about it? I mean, I guess we can talk with Doug a little bit about this. Well, Bandar wants to back them more. Bandar wants America to back them more. Okay, fine, but it's been the CIA coordinating the Saudis and the Qataris and all their money and all the guns and where they go all along. And I'm sure, you know, there are reports where the Qataris prefer the Muslim Brotherhood and the Saudis prefer the Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, the Levant, the Sham, whatever the hell they call themselves, according to whose translation or what. But then again, who was the smart guy came on the show, said that the chief sheik in Qatar has been replaced, kicked upstairs by his son, or maybe he died. And the son took power, and the son is much more on board with the Saudi way. Forget the Brotherhood. The Saudis hate the Muslim Brotherhood. And instead go with the Jabhat al-Nusra front instead. And whatever other groups. So, it's all treason. I mean, these are the guys who attacked the United States at Khobar Towers, which is in Saudi Arabia, you have to admit, but still killed American servicemen at Khobar Towers in 1996. There was an attempted attack, I think, in Saudi Arabia in 96, late 96 or 97 on the embassy there or something. I always get that fact muddled, but there's something about that. And then, of course, there was the USS Cole in the fall of 2000. Wasn't it the fall? I'm pretty sure. Right before the election, right? Or during it. During the election recount or some crap. Anyway, and then there was the attempted LAX attack. Of course, the Nairobi and Dar es Salaam in 98, the African embassies there. The attempted LAX attack of the year 2000. That got caught by an alert border guard on the Canadian border there. And then these are the guys who hijacked the planes and suicide crashed them on September 11th, hitting three out of their four targets and killing almost 3,000 people, the super majority of them civilians. And these are the guys who the American War Party is fighting for. I mean, and yeah, almost, sort of, kind of, literally, right? I mean, we have mostly a different army than we had then. People getting old, people getting dead, people getting maimed, people getting retired, and then we have new recruits in, right? Well, so yeah, a lot of these guys are new recruits. A lot of them are new as of 2004, 5, and 6, so that's not that new. They only came to Al-Qaeda in Iraq after George W. Bush created the space for them to exist as Al-Qaeda in Iraq in the Sunni triangle, the Anbar triangle there in Iraq. But they still are falling all over each other to declare their loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the guy who convinced bin Laden that they ought to bring everybody together by focusing on the far enemy, the United States, in the first place. So that makes them the guys. That makes them members of the same terrorist divisions that attacked the United States on September 11th. They're just different cells, different brigades of the same army. And why is America fighting for them? Why is America helping the Saudis back the suicide bomber, prisoner beheader, jihadist, bin Ladenite crazies in Syria right now? It's because that's what Israel wants. It's the only reason. It's because Israel's afraid of Hezbollah. Because Hezbollah has the right, has the ability, never mind even the right, they have the ability to resist Israeli incursions into Lebanon now. So that makes them an existential threat. The ability to act in your own self-defense? Why, that's an offensive, aggressive threat. And so, all the pressure in the American War Party is to commit high treason and to fight for Al-Qaeda's men against Nasrallah's men, against the Ayatollah's men in Syria. That's the way they see it, the Shiite crescent. And it's still amazing to me, and I know no one will ever give me credit when they finally ever do start saying it, but I think it's funny in a horrifying, ironical kind of, ain't it something else kind of a way, that they refuse to talk about Iraq's role in this whatsoever. The Iraqi government is on the side of Iran and the Ba'athist Shiite government of Syria and Hezbollah. You know, maybe in limited ways, but they're certainly still fighting the same Sunni-based insurgency that Assad is fighting in Syria. And they're allowing overflights of Iranian planes. Pardon me, I bit my tongue, although it didn't hurt too bad, I'm happy to report. They're still allowing Iranian planes to fly across their airspace and land in Syria, and then at least the accusations are these are planes full of men and material. Why not? And yeah, John Kerry occasionally and others in the American government do say, hey, Iraq, quit doing that. Hey, Nouri al-Maliki, our number one ally who we put in power there in Baghdad, would you please stop helping the Iranians in Syria for us? But of course, America's backing Maliki's enemies in Syria. We were talking about the other day those reports where Maliki was asking the CIA to help him target the Mujahideen in Iraq to try to chase them into Syria. Where, you know, you got to figure, it's all economics, right? When the bombs falling on the Sunni parts of Iraq are so bad that you're safer waging jihad in Syria, you balance that out. You cross the border, go fight in Syria. Where you make yourself useful in a regime change. And now the war nerd, John Dolan, tweeted out this morning about, here's this article about Israel bombing Syria and their attitude about it. And the way the war nerd put it was that they're more afraid of Hezbollah than they are of Al-Qaeda. But does that really make sense? Today, maybe. Does that make sense, taking into account the fact that there's such a thing as time and space that we're traveling forward through, and that soon what's now the future will be now, and that could be a problem, having a bunch of Al-Qaeda suicide bombers on your northern border? Hezbollah hasn't done a suicide attack since before the year 2000 anyway, when the Israelis withdrew from southern Lebanon, where they had no business invading and occupying in the first place. In fact, it was Abu Nidal that did an assassination that they lyingly blamed on Yasser Arafat as their excuse to invade southern Lebanon to chase after him back in 1982 in the first place. But anyway, Hezbollah, who they were, prime exploiters of that technology, that suicide bombing tactic in their day, they haven't been doing that in a long time. That hadn't been their thing, and they got power now. They're a little mini state in southern Lebanon. You think they want to give that up in a real war with Israel? They just want to keep Israel out. They don't want to give up their power. They have some. That's all the proof I need. And if they were in a real war where the Israeli government was determined to destroy them for real, then I think probably would not have ended like 96 ended. 2006. That was a limited incursion that did not go well for the Israelis at all, but it was not their best effort either. And I mean short of using nukes, too. I don't mean nukes. But, you know, I don't know. Every day on this show, for a minute, I pretend to put myself in the shoes of the leadership of the Israeli government, and I wonder, what are they thinking? What are they thinking? I mean, hell, they could have a peace treaty and get along with Nasrallah probably at this point if they wanted to. There are mutual interests there that could be exploited if one were seeking peace. You're certainly not going to get rid of Hezbollah short of a full-scale conflict, which would be problematic and would have consequences in Syria and Iran and elsewhere around the region as well. But to prefer Al-Qaeda to them? They're crazy. Likud means insane and stupid in Hebrew or in Yiddish or something, apparently. What are they doing? Does anybody ever ask them, hey man, what are you doing? Why are you acting as Al-Qaeda's air force in Syria right now? Benjamin Netanyahu, you damned fool. Anyway, so apparently it was a pretty big bombing raid, too. A base or two attacked. And this is their excuse, is that, well, these missiles were headed to Hezbollah. They say that was their intelligence. Now, you might even remember on the show, I actually even speculated one time that the Israelis finally, because, see, when I put myself in their shoes, I can't stop being, you know, lukewarm intelligence here, and so I can't help but assume that they have some intelligence, too, and that they've got to have some hesitation and some reticence to want to go full-fledged with this supporting the Salafist bin Ladenite jihadist suicide bomber types, right? They've got to be somewhat hesitant. And I even suspected that when the Israelis bombed some weapons inside Syria a few months back, that they said that, yeah, they were trying to keep them from Hezbollah, that they were on their way to Hezbollah. Maybe they were, I don't know. But perhaps there were other reports to reference anyway, indicating that maybe the deal was that they were afraid that these weapons were going to end up in the hands of the jihadists. And that they preferred to just use Hezbollah as their answer, because when they ever told the truth about anything anyway, and who cares about that? I don't know, but now I gotta figure that that was my mistake, is trying to assume any kind of rationality or intelligence on the part of the Israeli government whatsoever here. They really are that bad of damned fools that they don't care if Damascus falls to a bunch of suicide bombers, to a bunch of people who have sworn their allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri and his goals. And for that matter, are doing the dirty work of the king of Saudi Arabia. You know, I don't know. I don't know. I think, was it Alan Bach who said that power doesn't just corrupt, power makes you stupid. Power makes you assume that you're right, or else how come everybody else is listening to you? You must be the smartest guy in the room, but really, you're just the most powerful one. And so, you get that confirmation bias to the exponential power. It just gets completely out of control. You know? Hey, we all know what we're doing here, right? Yep, uh-huh. Like a bunch of truthers agreeing about bombs in the towers, you know? We all agree, don't we? Well, then that makes it an absolute fact. But anyway, so there you go. Israel on the side of Al-Qaeda. Just like America. And why? Because Israel's scared of Hezbollah, as War Nerd said. They're more afraid of Hezbollah than they are bin Ladenites. Self-proclaimed bin Ladenites. So, yeah, all right. By the way, let me just work this in here real quick. It's a couple of weeks old, but man, it's really worth your time looking at. It makes no difference. It's an evergreen article here. Where War Reporting Goes Wrong by Patrick Coburn, the heroic Patrick Coburn, writer for The Independent. Here he is still at Counterpunch as well. Where War Reporting Goes Wrong. It's a really good one. Well, it's more of an opinion piece, you know, than hard news. But of course, he was there when all this stuff he's referring to happened, so it's not like he doesn't know what he's talking about, but just a bit of perspective about the way the West wages war in the Near East and the Middle East and the ignorance that they act on, that they never stop acting on. With? Yeah. Oh, and then, yeah, man. See, here's the thing that I don't like. I don't like the Israelis interfering in Barack Obama's attempt to make a peace deal with the Iranians. And there's a new piece by Stephen Walt today at walt.foreignpolicy.com. He's the co-author of the book, The Israel Lobby. And there are a couple articles lately that say that, the Israel Lobby doesn't have that much power, and so therefore you're anymore, and so therefore you're a kook if you ever said they did, and whatever. So he tackles some of those questions. And so it's worth looking at in its entirety, but the part I wanted to focus on was he links to two more articles, and there are plenty. You can read just at foreignpolicy.com about it. You can read it in The Hill. You can read it in The Washington Post and The New York Times. You can read it anywhere. In this case, he links to The Forward and to Haaretz, both of them Jewish publications, one of them an Israeli publication, the other an American one. But, you know, both of them avowedly Jewish publications saying, hey, here are the facts, like them or hate them. It's the Israel lobby that is holding Obama's feet to the fire, as they put it, as Walt puts it here, on keeping all options on the table. On passing, here they are in Congress right now, trying to get past not just new sanctions, but a new authorization to use military force. That is a pseudo, a 20th/21st century style declaration of war against Iran. Right as Barack Obama is over there trying to make a peace deal. I mean, maybe. Is over there trying to make a peace deal. Right when Barack Obama is at least over there pretending that he wants to make a peace deal. And to be perfectly honest, I think there's really something to it. If you look at the things that, you know, the sound bites and the little press conferences that the State Department weenies hold after these talks, they believe in this. This is not messing around. Nobody's even bringing up old gripes. Nobody wants to fight about it. They're really trying to work this out. The original Iranian proposal it's fine, and that's just their original proposal, right? We can negotiate. But what they negotiated right off the bat is perfect. It takes care of everything that the crybabies are crying about right off the bat. There's no good reason not to deal. And again, and you can read this at CNN.com, they went and did the poll. 75% of the American people, you can't even get them to agree today's Friday. 75% of the American people want Obama to make this deal. I mean, it might have gone up if they had added the phrase hell or high water. No matter what it takes. The people want this to happen. And so who's against it? Who in America is against a peace deal? Which, a nuclear deal amounts to a peace deal. That's the one big fake excuse for conflict, is that they may someday make a nuke. So this is a huge first step down the path to a real normalization of relations between America and Iran, if it happens. And who's in the way of it? Only the Israeli government and their sock puppets in the United States, in Washington, D.C. That is the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, the American Enterprise Institute, and all of those official Israel lobby think tanks, and their membership. You know, the scum that you can read about over there at rightweb.com, where they do such a great job of keeping track of the most evil people in America, the most vile traitors among us. And you know what? Larry Wilkerson, who helped lie us into war with Iraq and has been doing penance ever since, was on the Real News the other day and said that he thinks that John McCain and Lindsey Graham are acting in a treasonous fashion here. And now the thing of it is, I'm not exactly sure the legal, for God's sake, Scott Horton, you're supposed to be a broadcaster here. The legal lingo. I don't know it. Seems to me that treason as defined as a felony crime in the Constitution only addresses acts on behalf of an enemy state, which at least implies an official state of war. And I don't believe that Israel is any kind of enemy state of the United States. They sure as hell are no friend. So I don't know what that limits the charges to as far as official grand jury proceedings go. But I can call it treason if I want. It is treason. It's some kind of crime against the people of this country who want a peace deal, who are sick and tired of this Cold War, this ridiculous Cold War with Iran, this horrible one. And, of course, the American people know where there's a Cold War and where there's a long-term policy of regime change, there will be a hot war. And a policy of regime change. Look at Iraq, recent history. I guess we never did have a H-bomb exchange with the USSR, so that's good. But anyway, you know what I mean. The American people want this thing settled. And normally, I don't agree with the American people on anything. But in this case, they want this thing settled. And there's just, you can't really point to anybody else except those who put their loyalty to Israel before their loyalty to America. And people who are paid liars and paid weapons lobbyists, maybe. And occasionally you might find a damned fool who goes around repeating like a minor bird what liars tell him to believe. But otherwise, the American people want this deal, and the Israel lobby and their agents, they're guilty of some kind of crime. And what they're doing is horrible. Pushing Congress. And you know the congressman? Well, you'll never find a more wretched hive of the worst things in the world as the men and women calling themselves the Congress of the United States of America. They're not even really people. You know, like Dianne Feinstein, for example. She's just the wife of an arms dealer. Well, I think he's more of like he does construction for military bases. Same thing. So there's this big, fat, horrifying welfare whore that steals money out of the treasury all day. And then he sends his wife to go pretend to be a senator and pass all the laws that make him rich. That's all it is. She's not even really a person. She's just, you might as well think of her as, you know, the most airheaded stooge from the PR and marketing department of, is it Richard Bloom? I forget. Bloom, Incorporated, whatever the hell it's called. I forgot what it was called. What's it called? Anybody in the chat room know Dianne Feinstein's husband's company's name? Anyway, these people are just horrible. And so all Israel and their sock puppets have to do, the Israeli government, their sock puppets have to do is say, hey, we'll give you money, or hey, we'll withhold money from you and give it to someone else instead. And they all roll right over like dogs. Like dogs. And so if a foreign state, and especially even the Democrats, go look at foreignpolicy.com, they got this thing all about Chuck Schumer and the Democrats in the Senate, who are the biggest obstacles to Barack Obama, their party leader and president of the United States, getting a peace deal done. Not he's trying to push us into war and they're trying to stop him. He's trying to sign a peace deal. And they want to leave that option for aggressive war open, on the table, forever and for always. It's ridiculous. But anyway, if the peace deal fails, you'll know who to blame. There's no one else to blame except the Israel lobby and the neoconservative movement in America. That's all it is. And they sign their names happily at the bottoms of all of their op-eds. And they'll, you know, smile right for the camera as they go marching around on Capitol Hill. And they make their secret deals too, I'm sure. It's mostly, it's just politics. They're very well organized and they're very single-minded. Whatever Benjamin Netanyahu says he wants, that's what they want. That's it. Simple as that. And they get it done. And who's a credible alternative to them? Who can say to a congressman with a straight face, don't worry about AIPAC, we will bankroll your campaign for standing up to them? Nobody. So if a foreign state calls for the U.S. Congress to obstruct a U.S. president's attempt to make peace, they will do it. They will do everything they can to try to stop him. Sure feels like treason. All right. The great Doug Bandow is coming on the show here in a minute. And then, oh man, I got a ton more news. AFRICOM, Afghanistan. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, you all, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Happy Friday to you. I hope you don't have to work on the weekends. Unless you really like your job, in which case I hope you have to work long hours all weekend long. Whatever. Anyway. Hey, guess what? On the phone, it's our old friend Doug Bandow from the Cato Institute and Forbes magazine. Welcome back to the show, Doug. How the hell are you?
Doing okay. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. It's very good to hear you again. It's very good to read you. It's always good to read you. I just love the stuff that you write. And in fact, if it's okay, I'm going to ask you about elephants to start here, because once we start on the Saudi thing, we're not going to get a chance to talk about elephants. But you wrote this brilliant thing that I wish everyone who cares about elephants in the world, which is, I think, all 7 billion of us, would read and translate it into whatever your local language is, all about how to prevent the extinction or the near extinction, this terrible, whatever you call it, a violent campaign, current violent campaign against elephants to preserve this wonderful animal, the Asian and the African, too. I guess the African more so are threatened by these poachers. But anyway, could you please just give them the nutshell version of how to protect elephants so that they continue existing?
Well, you know, elephants are fantastic creatures. The problem is, if you live around elephants, they're a real pain. That is, they destroy your villages, they destroy your crops, and they have these, you know, fabulous tusks, which ivory is very valuable, and it doesn't matter that it's against the law. Lots of people, especially in Asia, you know, want stuff made of ivory. So there's this huge market, you know, where people will kill elephants and just take the tusks. I mean, they care about nothing else. And local folks, I mean, you know, dozens of African farmers die every year trying to protect their farms from elephants. You know, they're quite happy to have poachers show up and kill the things, unless you kind of infuse them with value. And, you know, and it kind of, I know, runs against the grain of a lot of people I talk to, because they, you know, these are kind of fantastic creatures. I mean, they're very intelligent. They're very kind of family-oriented. Nevertheless, the best way to try to kind of protect them is to infuse value in them. So the point is, if you have an ivory market, then it makes sense to kind of keep them alive. You don't want to slaughter them all. And what you want to do is, you know, elephants die naturally. They, you know, some places they're over kind of population. They cull them. You know, you sell that ivory, and then you have to share that those proceeds with local villagers. In a sense, and what I tell people is, in the American experience is, we had buffalo and we had cattle. Cattle never went extinct because they were owned. People kind of had a reason to keep them and to, you know, maintain them. Buffalo were wiped out because they're just kind of masses of them. Nobody could care less. They just shot them all, left them all to die. We have to be much more creative here, because we talk about poor countries. They don't have effective militaries. They don't have effective park systems. You know, if you want to save the elephants, you've got to create some resources there and encourage especially local people to invest in them. You know, and right now we're not doing that very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess the whole public TV version of this would be, well, we just, you know, enlightened museum board of directors type liberal white people from the West should somehow, through the IMF or something, force these local governments in Africa to do as they're told, and to carve out giant pieces of their land to keep them as nature preserves, because we like looking at elephants and monkeys and stuff on TV. And so, you know, that's the end of that. They need to create a collectively owned, a state-owned area there, and then just that'll be it, right? Hire soldiers to keep the poachers out or whatever, and do it that way. And it sounds like what, you know, you Cato guys and your cruel, ruthless capitalism, you're saying that somebody ought to own these elephants, and that's even worse than poachers killing them where they're supposed to be protected on public land.
Exactly. I mean, I get responses. I mean, people see, I'll kind of say that, well, people should just stop wanting to use ivory. Well, yeah, I understand that, but that hasn't worked. And then I even had one person who wrote me and said, well, the U.S. military should put its troops in to protect elephants. And I'm trying to imagine, you know, President Obama announcing to the nation that we now are invading Zimbabwe to kind of protect the wildlife refuges. I mean, it's just, it ain't going to happen. I mean, we have to recognize kind of the fragility of these societies. They're impoverished. They're poor. You know, local villagers have a set of incentives here, which, you know, we white international types don't really understand. We don't live there. We're not under those conditions. So if you want to save the elephants, you've got to figure out something in the context of the reality where they're living, and markets help us there. And it doesn't matter that one may not, in theory, like markets. Well, in this case, they'll help to keep, you know, the creatures alive. Far better to have a lot more elephants surviving than to kind of be very pious, saying, I love elephants, but we can't do this terrible thing and kind of have markets in ivory and then have them all killed.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me, I mean, the economics of the black market dictate that you just can't stop it. And it seems like, except in the most extreme moral cases, like human slavery, where it must be absolutely universally outlawed, and that outlawing must be ruthlessly enforced, ultimately enforced, you know, as much as absolutely possible to stop any human slavery ever, you're still creating, you're just driving up the price and giving even human slavers more reason to get involved in the thing. Now, you can't make an exception there. But in the case of animals, we're talking about animals here. It's the same thing with birds. You know, the guys on Free Talk Live did a whole thing all about exotic bird smuggling and how many more of these awesome, the greatest birds ever evolved on Earth are completely destroyed because of the black market trade in them. It just makes no sense, you know?
No, it's really awful. I mean, you know, I think we share the objective. It's a question of means. And I say, hey, you know, the current system isn't working very well, so let's look for something else.
Yeah. And you can make that compromise when you're talking about elephants. Even if they are genius elephants, they're still animals, you know? We're not talking about little kids here.
No, that's right. I mean, that it's a different situation. There are certain moral imperatives of humankind that you can't kind of make exceptions with, where I think in animals you can. You can still respect them very much, but it makes sense to say, what's the most effective way to try to, you know, have the most of them around?
Right. All right, now, I'm going to be quiet, and you just tell everybody for 10 minutes why... Enough of the Saudis. We don't need them to tell us what to do, do we?
Well, yeah, it's so tiresome. I mean, you know, these, you know, the Saudi royals, you know, kind of are massively rich off, you know, their own people. They run this, you know, kind of theocracy and authoritarian state. And then they're out there lecturing America, and it turns out they're upset. They're mad at us. Well, because we won't bomb the Syrians. Oh, my, now we want to have negotiate with the Iranians. Oh, that's terrible. Oh, we don't like the Egyptian military because it's killing people. How dare we? Well, it's extraordinary. On the one hand, they talk, you know, cry crocodile tears on the, you know, the tragedy in Syria. And it is a tragedy, but these people don't care about tragedy. You know, they supported Saddam Hussein, who used chemical weapons against the Iranians. You know, they support the Egyptian military. They support the Bahraini, you know, Sunni monarchy, as it, you know, kind of cuts down protesters. So they don't care about kind of, you know, human beings. Everything's kind of politics, and they're mad because America isn't doing what they want. And my reaction is, well, tough. I mean, they need us more than we need them. I mean, if they don't sell their oil, you know, what happens to them? You know, they don't live the good life anymore. You know, they're desperate to sell their oil. You know, they need to sell it more than we need to buy it.
Well, maybe they can just sell it to the Europeans or the Japanese, though.
Well, the point is, it's an international marketplace. The more they sell to them, the more somebody else will send to us. You know, and they don't dominate. I mean, especially with all the changes happening in the energy marketplace these days, you know, with fracking and all these other things, you know, the Saudis are less important than ever in terms of their role in the energy marketplace. And if they don't sell it, what are they going to do, drink it? I mean, come on. Yeah, the good news is they need us more than they. I mean, you talk about who'd be in trouble if they don't sell it. You know, how are they going to fund all their little trips abroad? How are they going to try to pay off their military to protect them?
Yeah. You know, Michael Shorter, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, says that Bin Laden himself used those exact words, that even if it was him and his guys running things over there, they're still going to sell the oil. They're just going to charge you the market price instead of whichever one you're dictating this week.
I mean, whoever controls it, the only value is if you sell it. You know, I mean, to try to keep it off the market, the place falls apart. You know, we need to recognize that. You know, we have them over a barrel. They don't have us over a barrel.
Well, why does America put up with it at all?
Well, you know, there's that illusion of oil dependence, which, you know, we seem to think that we are so vulnerable when, in fact, we aren't. And I think part of it is Americans just don't pay attention to the fact it's an international marketplace. You know, our vulnerability has fallen. Even things like boycotts don't work. You just want to boycott America, well, it's no problem. I mean, if somebody in the Netherlands buys the oil and then sells it to an American and the tanker changes course in the ocean. I mean, you know, they've never had that kind of dominant power. Everybody in OPEC cheats. And now with this kind of fracking and all the new oil discoveries off Africa, Central Asia, you know, the importance of Saudi Arabia continues to fall. So Americans are kind of behind the times who think the Saudis have all this power. You know, they simply don't.
You know, I think this was in Michael Moore's movie, the Fahrenheit movie, back then. It was some kind of poll where the American people just assumed that Saudi Arabia was a modern democratic country, much like ours, because otherwise how come we're such bosom buddies with them? You know, people just rationalize like that. And you talk about the licentiousness of the leadership and their oppression of the regular people of Saudi Arabia. But, you know, I have to tell you, I think that story is pretty much a black hole here in America. We just don't hear that narrative very much about what life is like for Saudis there. And by the way, Charles Featherstone was on the air last week was on the show, and he was saying he did journalism out of Saudi Arabia for a while, and he said it's not a totalitarian society. There's still a lot of freedom, if it's not total freedom, whatever. It's not quite a nightmare, but what is it, Doug?
Well, look, I mean, it's very hard to have a true totalitarian state. I mean, what they do is, it's certainly not a democratic place. There's no, you know, kind of genuine elections. You know, the higher you up, you are up within society, the more opportunity you're going to have. But, I mean, bloggers who criticize royalty get in trouble. There are no elections. You know, there's no religious freedom. I mean, if you're a foreigner kind of worshiping at home, you know, you're probably not going to get caught. But any kind of a gathering of people, even at a private home, you know, Christian or otherwise, if, at least if you're not in a kind of a real foreign neighborhood, you can get arrested. You know, it's a nasty place in the sense that and the freedoms we would normally assume. I mean, one that's gotten a lot of attention is women driving. You know, women are, I mean, in a very different place there in terms of what they can do. A very male-dominated society, very rigid. So, you know, if you want, the question is, do you want to be there or in Joseph Stalin's Soviet Union? I'd say, sure, I'd be in Saudi Arabia. But, you know, it's a question of Saudi Arabia, frankly, in any other Gulf state. You know, you'd much prefer to be in Kuwait or Oman or Bahrain or any of the others because, I mean, they're all better in the sense of giving much greater space to private thought, you know, to private media, that sort of thing. So, I mean, Saudi Arabia really doesn't share American values. You know, a lot of the people are very nice. They have a real culture of hospitality. I mean, there's a lot of things there you can appreciate in individual Saudis. But the system, you know, it's a very authoritarian monarchy. An elite, you know, how you count it, 7,000 or more princes who basically dominate. You know, most of the money goes to them. You know, who gets to spend it all? I mean, a lot of Saudis aren't that well off because, I mean, the money doesn't get to everybody, especially the Shia minority. So it's not the kind of place that I think we would normally celebrate as being somehow consistent with American values.
Yeah. By the way, speaking of the Shia minority, that's basically up there in the Northeast where all the oil is. And so is it their property and the government is just, you know, collectivizes their property and steals all the oil out from under them? And how badly are they treated compared to the others?
Well, that's a good argument for that. You know, it's declared to be national property, so it's being, kind of developed for the nation. But, of course, who actually controls it? Well, it's, you know, the Sunni monarchy as opposed to the Shia who live nearby.
Yeah. And then how bad are they treated compared to, say, you know, I don't know, draw like a Jim Crow parallel? Better or worse than that compared to the majority?
I mean, you know, they're clearly second class. I mean, especially in terms of religious, I mean, the division between Sunni and Shia is very sharp. I hesitate calling it, you know, I mean, you know, there's a uniqueness to Jim Crow where it's your skin color that causes everything. But they clearly don't have, you know, any political influence commensurate with their status, you know, their ability to worship and have their own kind of imams, you know, and kind of their own preaching. I mean, all of that is circumscribed because the Sunni state is very nervous about what might be preached and what, you know, they don't want to have extremism, they don't want to have people threatening them. So, you know, all that stuff is pretty controlled.
Yeah, well, and that's the worst kind of tyranny, too. Over people's most sincere beliefs and that kind of thing, their basic conscience, what they think in their own mind, what
that's
they
right,
want to
exactly.
believe in. It's horrifying. And also stealing their oil. Imagine that. You shoot at the ground, up comes some bubbling crude,
yep.
And then down comes the government. Sarah Palin comes and nationalizes it, takes it all away from you.
That's right.
Like they're communists or something.
I mean, that's fairly common. You know, you look around and you try to find, you know, the source of money. So, you know, in the, you know, Middle East, you know, oil is the real source of wealth for these people. So you can be sure the government's going to do its best to monopolize the control.
Yeah.
And they do that quite well in Saudi Arabia.
All right. Now, so we got this whole, you know, you talked about the Sunni-Shia divide and just in Saudi Arabia. And obviously a big part of the American policy, at least in effect, is divide and conquer, although I don't know how good of a job they're doing at conquering. They sure as hell divide everybody pretty well. But it seems like right now, at least part of the establishment, because it ain't just the president, part of the establishment wants some kind of rapprochement with Iran, which seems to me like it could be a huge deal if they wanted to turn it into a real warming of and normalization of relations. And then that would really defang the entire, what I think is probably really a fake boogeyman anyway, this so-called Shiite crescent that has the Israelis crying all day, Hezbollah as backed by Syria, as backed by Iran, with a little help from Iraq on the side.
No, obviously it would be a huge reduction in tension if we could come up with some kind of a peaceful resolution with the Iranians. You know, the potential of war there, I mean, everybody's very nervous. The Kuwaitis, you know, it's a monarchy, but it's a relatively liberal place. I mean, this is a place where women are in business. You know, I mean, you go there, you'll find women who are, you know, Kuwaiti women who are dressed like Westerners. I mean, this is not nearly as repressive as, say, Saudi Arabia. Relatively free media, an elected parliament, assembly. You know, they have some political problems, but this is a place much freer. I mean, they're very nervous about, you know, Iran. Now, they're nervous about Iran in terms of what it could do, but they're even more nervous about the idea of war with the U.S. and Iran, you know, that they would get drawn into something like that. So if you could kind of diffuse those tensions, it would be huge. And a lot of what we see, the potential threatening behavior of Iran, well, of course, we're threatening them. I mean, you know, if you do that, you can't be surprised if they threaten others.
Oh, thanks, Doug. Appreciate it. Sorry, mic off.
Absolutely.
I do that.
Take
I'm
care.
Really bad at this. Thank you very much. Doug Bandow, everybody.
Bye-bye now.
Worst radio show ever. I mean, great interviewees, but otherwise, I wouldn't listen, would you?
Hey, all Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
All right, y'all. Man, I'm sorry at sucking so bad at radio. I could have swore I was sitting there talking to Doug, but he couldn't hear me because my microphone wasn't on because I turned it off and forgot to turn it back on again, which is a really stupid way to do a radio show. But, you know. Anyway, all right, everybody, that's the great Doug Bandow from Cato.org, and also at Forbes magazine, you can find these great articles. First of all, when you ban the sale of ivory, you ban elephants. And, of course, also his great article, it's time for Washington to tell Saudi Arabia to pound sand. Two great articles by Doug Bandow. And I really got a kick out of the ivory one. And you know what? It's true that people just mistake socialism for caring and whatever, even if it doesn't work. People would rather the government take jurisdiction and fail to protect the elephants than privatize the elephants and actually protect them. So one day they'll be gone. It's the same thing with the oceans. You got to privatize the oceans, and quick. And you know what? Maybe the worst scaremongering about all the overfishing is, I don't know, 100% overblown. But still, man, I don't know. I've read some stuff about the overfishing there that's pretty freaking scary, man. Where they're just there. You know, if they could take some time off and let the ocean kind of replenish itself a little bit, then that would be all right. But they can't take any time off. People got to eat. So they just keep fishing and fishing and fishing. But then they do it in the worst kind of way. They just clear cut, basically. Haul up as much as they possibly can of every kind of fish and then just keep what they want. Kill the rest. And on such a huge scale that it's really making a difference, you know? So eventually, the oceans will be dead. Because it's just the path to hell. Because there's nobody owns them. It's the tragedy of the commons to the nth degree. And all you gotta do is privatize it. And it won't be perfect. And I'm not exactly sure about how they'll work out the property rights over fish and mammals. And as they travel around and swim in the various directions they like swimming in. But it can be worked out. But you gotta make it in the fishermen's interest. Immediate interest to preserve what they're consuming too. It's the same thing with a copper mine. You know, if you own a copper mine, you could dig it all up and sell it all now at today's prices, or you could dig it up at a cost-effective rate now and have some for digging up later too. Conservation's built right into the pricing mechanism, you know. Where's the profit? The profit is in conservation. But, oh no, buying and selling elephants as livestock, it's just, oh, I don't know. It doesn't sound right to people. And it takes Doug Bandow to say, hey, wait a minute, man. We're going about this all wrong here. People just, they can't imagine it without Doug Bandow to show the way. So, three cheers for Bandow, man, because I love elephants. I've ridden on an elephant before, a small one, probably at Disney World, something like that. I got to ride on an elephant. I don't know if it wanted me on there. I guess it probably didn't. But it didn't seem to mind that much. I like elephants. I don't want some idiot with a rifle to hunt them all down just for their tusks. What if they were all gone and I couldn't watch them on TV anymore? Privatize the elephants. Same as the oceans. Privatize them. And quick before it's too late. Alright, I admit, I'm no Mark Thornton. I'm not the best at explaining economics. But I'm right about them. That's what I should do. I should get a Learjet, and I should fly from place to place. And then that way, instead of just interviewing these various guests on the show, I can go to where they are, and they can co-host the show with me. And it'll be a different person every day. Fly up to Toronto and have Eric Margolies be my co-host. And then fly over to Tennessee somewhere is where Bob Murphy lives and have him be my co-host for a day. Maybe for the expense, we're going to go a week at a time. Wouldn't that be fun? And then I could bring up topics, and then Robert Murphy could explain them in a way where he's actually right, you know, and knows what he's talking about. You know, like Doug Bandow. Privatize the elephants. Privatize Saudi Arabia. Wouldn't that suck if you were a Shiite Saudi Arabian? You know, some guy. And you lived on some land, and that's where the oil was, and it was your oil. And then the government came and stole it all, and not only that, oppressed you over it. That don't seem right to me. Don't they have property rights? Aren't they people too? What the hell? How much are they getting bribed? They should be getting bribed a lot to have the government stealing their oil like that. Seems like to me, anyway. Oh, yeah. I had this thing yesterday, the sidebar. This is for people who are just trying to keep track. I never did get around to explaining it very well, and I probably won't now either, but this is just in case you're jotting down notes here. America is fighting Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, at least sort of kind of in Mali and Nigeria, and also helping Maliki fight them in Iraq. While at the same time, of course, we back them in Iran, Syria, and Libya. And in all cases, the policy benefits our enemies, the only real enemies America has. Now, a lot of this, like I was complaining before, is because this is what Israel wants, because their priority is Hezbollah in Syria. in Iran, of course. In fact, yeah, that's pretty much it. But the thing is, where we go to fight them, we just make them more powerful and spread them all over the place. And then where we directly fight for them, well, what the hell are you going to do? I mean, you're shipping them guns and money. That's helping them too. Though it might cost them a little bit of credibility, right? The Israeli Air Force intervening on their behalf, the Americans arming them all the time. You guys are sellout suicide bombers, dude. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Some stock market investors are making money hand over fist, while others sit on the sidelines afraid of the dangers. Are you looking for answers? Before you invest $1, I'd like you to take the time to watch this new video from Martin Weiss at moneyandmarkets.com. The video names the 7 riskiest and 4 safest major stocks in America. Learn from the experts and invest wisely. Go to crisis16.com. That's crisis16.com.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back. It's the show. I'm him that hosts the show, Scott Horton. And today's the anniversary of the assassination of Diem, the American sock puppet dictator of South Vietnam back in 1963. And of course, you know, turnabout, something, something. John Kennedy did it, killed Diem, and then died a few weeks later. And the thing about it is, and I'm no master historian of the Vietnam War. I'm younger than that. I mean, I know some about it. One of the things I picked up along the way, I don't know how well I could source this for you. You may know better than me. But one of the things I picked up about Vietnam somewhere was that there were two major families in South Vietnam that were, you know, kind of vying for power. And one was Diem's family, and the other was the other guy's. And the thing of it was, the Americans, I guess not too unlike myself, they were so racist and impatient, they never figured out who everybody's last name was. They just called everybody by their first name. You know, like Ho Chi Minh was just Ho. That kind of thing. And they just called them all like that. And I don't know, I guess Diem was one of his last names or something. But anyway, the thing I was reading was saying that the State Department guys and the CIA guys and the military guys and the National Security Council guys making the policy that, yeah, you know what we ought to do? We ought to get rid of Diem and replace him with this other guy. That they had no idea what they were doing. Their map of high society in among the French allied Catholics in South Vietnam, their ruling class, was pathetic and wrong. And perhaps non-existent. And when they tried to replace Diem with what's-his-name that came next, it was the hugest blunder in the whole world. If anyone had the ability to hold on to South Vietnam and own it as a separate South Vietnamese government, I mean, all things being equal as far as North Vietnamese and other intervention, by the way, but you know what I mean. If anybody could have been the government at all, it would have been Diem. And by replacing him with the other guy, they replaced his faction with the other faction, which was much weaker. Not that either had popular support. At all. Really. But the whole war was against the people of South Vietnam to try to foist this government on them. And the one that had the best chance of getting away with it was Diem. And they killed him because he wasn't doing a good enough job because, hey, yeah, that's what Kennedys do. They just kill people. Whatever. Big deal. And the thing of it is, here's a parallel. What if Barack Obama just said, you know what? Things aren't going exactly my way. Let's just murder Hamid Karzai, our sock puppet dictator of Afghanistan right now, and we'll replace him with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. Or General Dostum. I don't know General Dostum's first name. Mass rapist murderer, something like that. It rhymes with that. We'll just put him in charge. But actually, no, because actually Karzai figured out how to bribe Hekmatyar, Dostum, and four or five other warlords. Now you're putting one warlord in power who's got to get to bribing everybody. Or defeat them. Right? Just create a whole new set of conflicts. And, of course, that's not to argue that Karzai is in any good position if America does leave Afghanistan. Big if. We'll see Karzai probably fall quickly. Although I suppose it's possible he could cobble together some kind of coalition. He is a Pashtun, even though he does nothing but war against Pashtuns and preside over their mass murder all the time for years on end now. 9 years in a row now. But you could see how just foolhardy that would be, right? Can you imagine if Obama did that? Just go ahead, even if think, you know what if Afghanistan doesn't go your way? Oh, domino theory, this, that, and the other thing. I'm just going to kill Karzai? What had DM even done and made him so bad anyway? But then the point being that they just completely, not only was it a ruthless murder of their loyal sock puppet that they betrayed and killed, but it was a gigantic mistake in terms of their imperial policy. They didn't even know who they were dealing with or what. And it only undermined their war effort rather than strengthened it. And so, I don't know, man. It just seemed, I guess the reason I wanted to mention it, I saw somebody brought that up today, and the reason I wanted to mention it is because I thought of the Karzai analogy, and that helped me to understand in context how bad it was what they did to DM. Because, you know, I guess I admit, I learned about the murder of DM and his overthrow when I was so young that I didn't have quite enough context to compare that to, maybe. I don't know. Not that it was okay, but it was just okay. So that was a thing that happened back in history before I was alive. Something that John Kennedy did in black and white footage or whatever. I don't know. It was just a thing. Yeah, and then there was this coup and they killed DM. But now I'm looking at it like, okay, that would be like if Obama just whacked Karzai right now, or if Bush had just turned around and whacked Jafari or Alawi or Maliki and said, no, I don't like you. I mean, they pushed Jafari out, right? But they didn't just kill him. They hired another guy from his same party, actually, different faction of his same party, the Dawa party. But I thought of it when I saw that it was the anniversary of the DM thing, it made me think of the context. What if Obama just outright betrayed and murdered Karzai right now? They did try to oust him under an election, didn't work, and they abided by that, right? He stole the election better than they could. And so they went, okay, well, and they let him win it. They didn't kill him. But if they had, just think of what a scandal that is. Think of how huge that is. Think of what a big deal that is. For America to be fighting, America to be at war in a country in the name of fighting for their government against the horrible enemy within, and then killing them and overthrowing them with choicer sock puppet dictators. That sure does kind of give away your whole hand there, huh? And it'd be nice if we could all pretend that LBJ did it, but he didn't. And what a bunch of ruthless murderers the American government has always been, huh? They sure do kill whoever they feel like a lot, don't they? Oh, DM. Boss, we were talking about it, and we think that we had an interagency deputies council meeting, and we decided that we should kill DM and replace him with this other guy. What's his name? Okay, go ahead. Here's my signature in ink on a piece of paper telling you to just go right ahead and kill this guy, our loyal sock puppet. Dictator of South Vietnam. And then, yeah, we'll have a new one. And then Malcolm X said that John Kennedy's assassination was just chickens coming home to roost. Well, it doesn't seem like that's what it was. It was something else entirely. Whatever it was. It wasn't a South Vietnamese communist radical who fired that shot. But his point was, hey, man, if you live by violent and destructive means, things like this happen. You could even quote Jesus saying the very same thing. And, of course, that got Malcolm X in big trouble because that was a very mean thing to say about the beloved leader. But he was just being honest. And, frankly, I don't see the personal attachment to presidents. Don't get me wrong. I'm not for anyone hurting any presidents at all. Other than if they're impeached and removed and indicted and convicted and they lose their appeals, they just go to prison and then they get beat up in prison or something like that, like everybody else. Well, those are the breaks. I certainly don't want to see any bloody exchanges of power in America. I want to repeal the state, maybe even overnight, but not with a war, you know? I just want everybody to stop loving it, stop believing in it, make it go away. But boy, the tears people shed over their imperial overlords. Speaking of Malcolm X, the house slave and the field slave, I can't say it the way he said it. He had license too. I don't. But you understand the distinction. I don't see how it's really a racial issue. You know what I mean? You pledge your loyalty to those who dominate and exploit you, or you hate them. Sort of one or the other. You put them first or you don't. Pretty easy to see what side you're on when somebody puts it to you that way. Isn't it? Isn't it? But, people crying. Malcolm X, you can't say that. People are still crying their eyes out over this ruthless mass killer. Something bad happened to the ruthless mass killer, and everybody's still very emotional right now, Malcolm X. So please don't point out the obvious that if you live by violent and destructive means, you could possibly end violent and destructively too. Like that guy Michael Kelly, who was a lying warmonger in 2002 and 3 and then died in the initial invasion of Iraq. By friendly fire, apparently, or somebody hit his Jeep with a mortar, something like that. Well, what was he doing there? He had helped tell a bunch of lies to sell the people who could possibly have helped to stop the thing, which would have been the centrist liberal establishmentists, who the Iraq War wasn't really their idea. They had to be brought along by the more ambitious of them, like Michael O'Hanlon and what's his name? Pollock. Had to be convinced. Justin Romano's got a great article at antiwar.com today. You should click all the links in that article, and you should read every article linked to in that article. And then you'll be really good on the Iraq War. I gotta disagree with one part of it, though, where he says that the surge sort of succeeded in tamping down the violence in a sense, in one way, like kind of half-handing it to him. No, not really, other than maybe if you one further step away from success in that, yeah, they helped the Shiite militias finish purging Baghdad of the Sunni Arabs and turned it into an almost completely Shiite Arab city. And then at that point, the Sunni Arabs kind of had to pause and lick their wounds because they had just been completely whooped. And so there was, you know, a pause in that sense. I wouldn't necessarily call that a tamping down as much as a pushing out and then a break in the fighting because of the change in dynamics of who was who and what they were fighting for anymore. They had been fighting to hold on to Baghdad after they didn't have Baghdad to fight for anymore. It became a different situation. Anyway, minor quibble, whatever. Anyway, the thing is great, and especially all the links in that great article. Click on them all and read all the articles that are linked within at antiwar.com/Justin today. It's refuting John McCain and Lindsey Graham and David Petraeus writing in Foreign Policy about how the surge worked. Yeah, the surge worked as the most successful slogan at convincing people to believe something false so that they will consent to more mass killing. And probably all other slogans, or I don't know, Hail Hitler, I guess. That was a good one. People love that one, man. Get it? You see how both word begins with H? What a powerful slogan. You got control of my mind. But anyway, the surge worked. It does have a special kind of a little ring to it, doesn't it? The surge worked. The surge is working, actually. That's how it went for the spring and summer of 2007. The surge is working. The surge is working. The surge is working. Hey, you were against the surge in Iraq, but the surge is working, okay? Nobody ever talked about what they were talking about. All they ever did was just chant it like an idiot, like a junior high school girl at a pep rally. Surge is working. Yeah, working at doing what? Well, we found 700 bodies this morning. All of them had power drill holes in their heads. The surge is helping the people with the power drills to round up these men to torture to death with said power drills. Surge, 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 working, working, working. And then they said, guess what? The surge worked. And nobody asked them, oh yeah, it worked at doing what? And sometimes they would go so far as to say, well, there was a somewhat reduction in violence. The furthest thing from peace. And then they would never have to defend their case against someone else denying it. Never. Would they have to take on the argument that no, the Sunni Arabs were already turning on Al-Qaeda. The Sunni Arabs had been begging you in the summer of 2003, 4, 5, and 6 to please just pay them a little bit of money, let them keep their weapons, and let them patrol their own neighborhoods instead of foisting the Badr Brigade army on them, and they'll quit resisting for a minute, that whole wound-licking thing I was talking about, that pause in the fighting there. And of course, Muqtada al-Sadr, the Americans picked the fight with him for no reason whatsoever in 2007, even though he was who they were fighting for all along. He's the king of Iraq right now. You can read it in the links in Justin's article. Sadr is the number one beneficiary. He was always at least the second most powerful man in the United Iraqi Alliance after Abdulaziz al-Hakim, but al-Hakim died. And his son couldn't keep it up, as far as the metaphor. And so Sadr took over the entire Supreme Islamic Council and basically is the entire power behind the throne. Him and his Mahdi army, they're the only ones with actual might and actual street credibility as leaders among the Shiite Arabs in Iraq. And there are some other, you know, armies and whatever, the Fadl all, whatever the hell, down in Basra and whatever. But none of them measure up to Sadr. So what were they doing picking a fight with him? Just because they didn't want him to be the most powerful of the faction they were fighting for. He was the subset of this alliance. I'm sorry, I'm being so repetitive, but I think this is important. The entire war in East Baghdad and down to Basra in 2007, that entire surge. Again, the Sunni insurgency, they had a ceasefire, a temporary so-called awakening deal. It wasn't Petraeus' idea, it was theirs. He only finally accepted it. But they weren't fighting the Sunni-based insurgency anymore, just barely at that point. They turned all their direction against Sadr, who inside the United Iraqi Alliance, he was just one of the three, he was one of the three factions. The Dawah Party, the Supreme Islamic Council, and the Sadrs. And they were trying to marginalize him and trying to hurt him and weaken him, but all they did, if anything, was give him more credibility as the guy who, unlike the Hakims in the Supreme Islamic Council, is unwilling to compromise with the Americans and do everything their way. And he's smart, he just bided his time. And as Raimondo points out in his article today, he didn't give Maliki any choice. Nouri al-Maliki, the current prime minister, he may have wanted to go along with the Americans, although I don't really think so. I think he was playing Obama the same way he was playing Bush in 08, playing Obama in 11, the same way Bush was playing, the same way he played Bush in 08. But anyway, Muqtada al-Sadr didn't give him a choice. Muqtada al-Sadr said, dude, if you try to allow the Americans to stay, you're a dead man. Not only do you have no power, but you're finished. And Maliki took that to heart, I guess. And I told you this. Go back and listen to my interviews in 08, all through 08, and all through 2010 and 11, too. I talk about how I think what Maliki's doing is playing the Americans. The Americans keep saying, we want to stay past 2011, renegotiate Bush's deal. Bush signed the deal that said they'd be out at the end of 2011 in 2008. And they're replicating that plan. And I said, you just watch. Maliki keeps telling the Americans, oh, yeah, no, I want you guys to stay, too. Here, I got to go back and convince the guys. I'll let you know what they say, you know? And then, you know, I talked with the guys, and they're really hesitant to go along with the thing. But I'll tell you what. You guys wait right here. I'm going to go talk to the guys again and see if I can convince them for you. Because, no, I'm totally with you. I want you to stay. I really, really do. And then he just did that for a year. What are you going to do? The clock's running out. And if you don't have a deal that says immunity for the troops, the military won't stay in a place like Iraq where they have to commit war crimes all the time to stay alive. And so you can't have them subject to the laws against war crimes. And so that was it. And you know what? By the way, too, here's another thing I was right about all along, too, that we talked about all along on the show. If you want to be a good imperialist, you prop up the minority dictator, like Saddam Hussein, the Sunni dictator, over the Kurdish and Shiite majority, especially the Shiite majority. That makes sense as a model, because then the dictator needs you. He needs you to either starve these people or bankroll you against them or something, one way or the other. That was one of the other policies against Iraq there for the 80s and the 90s, right? But when you fight a war for the majority, once they win, then bye-bye for you. They don't need you no more. And that was settled. We were talking about that on my show from, 2005 on or something. And what was the great quote from Paul Bremer had, you know, the daughter of some Republican donor following him around with a clipboard. And he said to her, he said, hey, who's this Sadr guy? Paul Bremer, he was the viceroy of Iraq. Who's this Sadr guy? And she goes, oh, he's some minor cleric. Oh, yeah, just some minor cleric. Or she might have even been talking about Sistani at that point. He's the highest ranking religious Shiite authority in the world. Minor cleric, Sadr, much lower religious rank than that, but a hell of a lot more, or at least as much credibility with the people of Iraq, that's for sure, with the Shiite Arabs of Iraq. So that whole war, I always talk about the book, The Good Soldiers, and you know, I should do a better job of tying this into the video you've seen of the Apache helicopter massacre, the Reuters report, or the WikiLeaks video, the Chelsea Manning WikiLeaks video. And there's Ethan McCord, is the guy who rescues the two children that his buddies in the helicopter had just attempted to slaughter. They were terribly wounded, although I think both survived. That was the rescuer's children in the collateral murder video. And that was their battalion is, or I don't know all the battalions and brigades and all of that stuff. Sorry. But anyway, it was their group under Lieutenant Colonel Kozlarich in East Baghdad that's profiled in the book, The Good Soldiers. And every lost life in that book is just absolutely wasted, even compared to the mission, okay? I'm not talking about in the way that every life in the entire war was wasted, but I'm talking about in specific. The war outside of East Baghdad, the whole time, and including at the time this book, Good Soldiers, is taking place, 2007 and early 08, that whole time and the whole war was fought for Sadr. and every person that those men killed and every one of them that got killed in the time period profile in that book was just, it was George Bush's treason against the U.S. Army is what it was. How could he do that? I mean, they could claim that they're trying to marginalize and weaken Sauder as, you know, to make him the weakest member of the United Iraqi Alliance, but what a horrible strategy. It came a million miles from working. And he's the boss right now. He's the one who insisted that Maliki had no choice, had to kick us out, as he'd been insisting all along, but he had Maliki by the short hairs by then. And anyway, I don't know. It's just a miracle to me. It's well, whatever. No, it's not. It's just a testament to American journalism is what it is. That these guys can get away with saying the surge worked at all. Why it worked? Because it's three words that are easy to memorize? It ain't fair, man. People got to have their lives wasted. And you know what? The ones who are dead, they're dead. And I know how people feel about that. I feel sort of the same way. They don't even know they're dead. They're just dead. And so it is what it is, but it's over now, kind of. But what about those that are horribly maimed and they're in the hospital now and for the rest of their lives in horrible pain because they were horribly maimed during the war for East Baghdad where they were fighting against the guy they were fighting for all along? That doesn't seem fair to me. You know? I think that when you sign up for the army, the deal is, hey, we'll try not to friendly fire you to death. But not, we'll send you to die fighting the forces that you're fighting for. What? That'd be like backing Al-Qaeda in Syria, man. That's some kind of treason. All right. Man, I'm sorry I keep not getting to these AFRICOM articles. Training and raids. U.S. prepares African surge. That's Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Pentagon dollars flowing into Africa. There they are in their fancy new killer death boats. Special forces war. Hey, wherever anyone in Africa resists, call it aggression and kill them. And then just keep going from there. It's perfect. It's a whole continent worth of people to enslave. And or just murder. And who can stop them? Who's organized to stop them? American Democrat? Oh, they're the ones doing it. Who's going to stop them? They'll just take Africa if they want it. It's like that movie where the world turns upside down or whatever, and everybody dies except those most politically connected. Oh, 2012, the Cusack flick. And at the end, what do? They go, we're going to Africa, the one land that was unaffected. We're going to kill every black man there, and we're just going to take it for ourselves. That was the implication at the end of the movie, right? Yeah, we're going to start all over again. The people who already live here, yeah, they don't count. They're going to have to look out. I apologize in advance to the people of all 90-something nations on the African continent or whatever it is, 52 or whatever. You're doomed. Apologies.